Hi there, listener. It's Matthew. You've come looking for an episode of the Children's Book Podcast, and you've found it. Hooray! But you're probably wondering why the name of the podcast has changed. After 8 years of doing the Children's Book Podcast, I began a new career as head of podcasts at A Kids Company About, where I now oversee a podcast network dedicated to producing original content that talks up to kids, centers the things going on in their world, and engages and challenges how they see the world and themselves. All of the episodes of the Children's Book Podcast are still here, but now, if you're subscribed, you'll get new episodes of Worth Noting, a kids podcast about current events, hosted by me. Something for you and the young people in your life to enjoy together. Enjoy this episode, and I hope you'll check out Worth Noting and other podcasts from A Kids Company About. Meet Lucy Ruth Cummins, debut author-illustrator, art director, a person who imagined a book title then set out to make sure it delivered on its promise. Welcome to All the Wonders, the Children's Book Podcast. I'm Matthew Winner. This is episode number 270 of the podcast with Lucy Ruth Cummins, author-illustrator of A Hungry Lion, or A Dwindling Assortment of Animals. A Hungry Lion is a book that found its way to me, at a point when it seemed that all of my friends in and around children's publishing were talking about this great book. A copy appeared on my doorstep. We read it that night for bedtime. 3 pages in, and I was sure I had it figured out. I loved the art. I loved Lucy's style, but 3 pages in, and I thought I had her number. But then she surprised me. What's more than that is that I kept reading, now wondering what else could be in store, having nearly half the story left to read. But another surprise was waiting, and a third. And so it continued until my son and I were no longer sleepy-eyed, but awake and alive with excitement for this great story. I say all of this because talking to Lucy, yeah, all of those great story beats were in this conversation too. I sincerely hope you enjoy this chat. Here's episode number 270 of the podcast with Lucy Ruth Cummins. Welcome to the podcast, Lucy Ruth Cummins. I'm so excited you're here.
I'm very excited to be here or be here remotely with you.
I'm not gonna lie. I mean, granted, I've loved the 22 minutes we've already talked off recording, but right now, my smile, I can feel my cheekbones pushing my headphones off my ears.
This is happening. I can feel your cheekbones pushing your headphones, pushing my headphones. And I'm responding in kind because I'm very excited to speak to you and I'm very excited to talk to you about books.
Well, I'm excited to talk to you about one particular book, and that would be your picture book debut, A Hungry Lion, or A Dwindling Assortment of Animals. May I just say that this might be the most British-sounding title of any non-British person, and I love it.
I have to say that it was when I was titling it, I was wrestling with one or the other, and then there was this moment of, no, both. It's both. It has to be both.
It has to be both.
Yes, and it's very funny, too, because on acquisition, I guess, it was read aloud in a British accent, because that was just the assumption in the room of how it should be handled, without knowing that I was the creator, which was very weird.
And even knowing that you're the creator now, for me, I hadn't known you or where you are from.
Yeah.
So seeing on your cover that you use your middle name, Lucy Ruth Cummins, felt, again, in my brain,
I had
this sort of name of like, oh yeah, this is, I could see this going this direction.
Yes.
Love it. Well, why don't I before I go all fanboy on you, why don't I just give you a moment to share with the listeners your book talk, your pitch. Okay. What is A Hungry Lion or A Dwindling Assortment of Animals?
It's a book that delivers on its promise. One of the things that I really wanted to get across was, if this is the title of this book, this should be your expectation. And I didn't want to cheat anyone on what I was offering with that title. So to me, and the way that I had conceived of it, it's basically a mystery or a murder mystery in 40 pages, I think, self-ends.
I'll give you that. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, I mean, maybe that's too grim, but I think it might be accurate. And I think that to say anything else about a title like that would be inaccurate.
I love it. I mean, you have just the way that, I just realized that now that I've read this book, maybe call it 10 times with my son at night, there's a moment at the end that I'm going to have to tell you off recording because it will spoil a part of the story. But it's so sweet that Jonah now sort of, almost as part of your text, asks this question or says this comment about a character at the end of your story every time. And it's just become, for him, part of the canon of this story. It's beautiful.
Oh, I love that. That's so cool.
But you've got sort of, I love that, Lucy, you've got sort of a act one and act two in your story. That there is a great surprise in the story, but one of my favorites, and do you mind if I read to you and those people listening at home, is that okay?
I would be nothing but honored.
Just to give a sense of what we're dealing with here, we start off with a large cast of characters that dwindles, as the title suggests, and so I just want to read who we have, and then I'll read one page flip. So, once upon a time, there was a hungry lion, a penguin, a turtle, a little calico kitten, a brown mouse, a bunny with floppy ears, and a bunny with unfloppy ears, a frog, a bat, a pig, a slightly bigger pig, a woolly sheep, a koala, and also a hen. And then on the flip, hold on. Once upon a time, there was a hungry lion, a penguin, a turtle, a brown mouse, those two rabbits, one with ears that flopped and one with ears that did not, a frog, a bat, a regular-sized pig, a koala, and a hen. And the voice of you, the author, illustrator, almost to me, and I say author and illustrator because there were page turns where it felt like, to me, you were drawing while you told the story, and so on the next page, you were like, wait, where did that thing go that I just drew?
it's a weird balance. It's very funny too, because when I read it, as you can tell from that section that you just read, and when I read it aloud with children, I usually gesture to each of the animals, so we're keeping good track of who's there. And me, even as the person who wrote and illustrated that book, really has to search them out still. Like, I can't quite remember where they're placed on the page just because of the volume at this point. So I want to apologize in advance to anybody who has to read this to a group at how much searching it requires early on. It's a little tricky.
The one with the bunny with unfloppy ears, he after a couple reads, was, oh, I thought that was a puppy.
You know what? I have had that asked, and it was also addressed in a review. that my articulation of the floppy-eared bunny was too much like a puppy.
Ew.
Which I know. But
I disagree.
Well, it was very funny, though, because then a child came up to me at a reading that I had done, and he had seen the book in advance and liked the book, and he came up with his mother, and he said to me, I really like dogs, and I wondered why there isn't a dog in the book. And I said, I really like dogs too, and that's exactly why. So I've left them out of the fray for good reason.
For
but
good
that
reason.
That floppy-eared bunny seems to mislead a few people, which I don't mind too much.
Yeah, honey, a dog and a hungry lion doesn't fare well.
Yes,
I
exactly.
I like them too much.
I like them too much.
That's also why there are no children in this book.
Yes, exactly. I don't want to have to put like special labels on it.
That's
no NC-17 or anything.
We don't
like
need
that.
To go all roll doll on.
Yeah,
on
exactly. We don't want to go full tilt on this.
Can I give you an aside here? Can I just ask
sure.
you? And I'm coming at this now having, again, not knowing this prior to record or prior to talking to you, but I learned that you are the art director, one of the art directors, or the art director at Simon & Schuster.
I wish I could say I was the solo art director there. We have a kind of a huge,
we have
a lot of people. So within, I'm the art director or one of the art directors for Simon & Schuster Books for Young Readers.
Okay.
And also I work with Paula Wiseman Books
in that
capacity. So two imprints. I work with a kind of a fairly largish small team. So I've been with Simon & Schuster and Paula Wiseman Books for 13 years now, as of May. Yeah.
Right, so in that time, you've seen a lot of books, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I point back to Betsy Bird and Jules Danielson, their book, Wild Things, about the subversion in books, right? And in your book, you deal with the topic of disappearing, of being eaten, which is all natural in animals. But do you see a lot of, I think of like John Crossan's book, animals being eaten. Death by consumption is like a very common thing in children's literature. That's why is that? I'll share my theory, but
I want to hear yours first.
So my theory is for children, it's a little less horrifying and more mystical to just be sort of gobbled up in one bite.
Yes. Yeah. Well, you know what's so funny? I feel like the weird thing is I come from a huge family. I'm the youngest of six. Maybe not huge, because maybe you'll then say you're from seven. I don't know. So I have 11 nieces and nephews. And in my experience, sharks and dinosaurs and eating and those kind of predator and prey relationships are often a part of pretend and make-believe play. Mm. It's not something that's lost on them, that there's kind of a hierarchy in a food chain, which is true on your plate, too. So I think that for some readers, that'll be very off-putting. But for others, in the context of being like sweet little drawings, is more of a way of thinking through that idea without being scared of it necessarily.
I love that.
Because it's obviously pretty approachable.
Of course. I mean, like a group of us at All the Wonders. We're sort of talking about it the one day over the phone.
Yeah.
I'm like, I wonder why, and why don't you see this, and why don't you see that? Why is that sort of the mode? But then to have you draw from the idea that, well, we play a lot that way. That's perfect.
I feel like that's accurate. I mean, maybe that's a good excuse for making the book I wanted to make. But I definitely feel like John Classen kicked that door down and said, like, not only are you going to love a book where a character dies, we're talking, you know, in a picture book form, you're going to read it relentlessly, even though you know what's about to happen.
Right.
And I think that there's sometimes with reading with children, and I have this from the perspective of as an aunt, but also then as an art director of picture books, that there's almost a thing that happens when you read a book a second time, especially with it. It has content that you're kind of wrestling with or thinking through, where you'll see in a child that the second time gives them the closeness and understanding to say, I'm kind of mastering this thing I'm thinking about, or I'm kind of moving forward with it. And knowing what is about to happen is kind of an empowering thing, especially when something could be qualified as, like, quote, scary or something like that. That, like, being on the inside in the way that the picture book is read, obviously, more than once, is kind of empowering in that way, too, I think. I hope.
I even just from my experience of reading it, it has to be from my experience of reading it to my son, because as a librarian, I don't read the same book to children over and over, so I don't get that experience. I read the same book to many, many classes, but it's always the first time.
Yeah.
I can say with my own that not only does the pace change when you read it more than once, right? Which is a great thing, because you end up going, in this book in particular, as the animals are getting smaller and smaller in number, you end up the first time going like, well, how long is this going to go on? But the second time, and third and fourth, and all the subsequent times, you're almost racing toward the moment that you know is going to happen. But I would also say then that the repetitious reading allows you to find a lot of humor in it. And that's sort of what we need, right? Like all of us, we adults, when we grew up, the reason why we understand things the way we do and can brush things off the way we do and kids can't is because we've experienced them 100 times and kids, kids haven't. They've experienced them once or twice. So it still breaks the heart when things like that happen. But in a picture book, you read it 10 times as we have and suddenly you get it and you laugh at the end.
Or you don't, because I've encountered some children who don't and don't enjoy and don't think I'm a good person and don't think I did a nice thing. And then there's the flip side of which are like the really eager appreciators of what you've done when you've done something sort of dark. And those people are another category of people that you can, you know, either be excited for or a little curious about. But like, I've definitely, because now I've done a couple of different bookstore visits where I've had a chance to share it with different groups of kids and different ages. And I can confidently say there's an age where you think this is funny and there's an age where you think, I don't know if I like this. And that, how is that otherwise nice seeming lady? And I frequently show up to these things now with both my husband and my infant son. And I think in the context of those two, like, people, it's especially concerning. I don't know. Like, she gets to take that baby home with her. Do they know what she did in that book?
How hungry is she?
Does she have
cake?
Yeah, I know. Oh, there's always got to be cake, though. Every good book has cake, right?
Right?
Oh, not that this one necessarily does. Let's not forget.
It's got a hungry lion, though, and let me tell
you. Yes.
I like your art in this, Luce. I like that. Again, like when I was reading it, and I don't come from the world of art, but I do come from the world of feeling and emotion.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And for me, again, when I read it, I knew you wrote and illustrated this book, and it felt to me, because of the voice in the story, like you were discovering as we went too.
Yeah.
And so to me, that became really important when it went in your illustration. The lion looks like he was just sort of colored with a marker, and you've got these thick lines like that. And the and the animals sort of have, you know, like the there's a, some in some places there's like white space around them.
Well, yeah, you know, it's so funny. My husband often makes fun of me because my process for making art is it's very pleasure focused, and so for me, like as things snap together, I end up pulling every material I kind of have handy, which I think ends up having that effect that I hope is frenetic and fun to look at.
So let me picture, you're the kind of person then that, like, you're drawing going like, oh yeah, this is it. All right.
Yeah,
so,
and like, look at this. But then, I mean, I think that that also, like, and this is like the horrible, like, side of that, of liking what you do. Then you know, I share it and like, my husband, who has a very different sensibility because he's in a very different field in the arts, he likes things that are a little more, maybe would naturally do things a little more rendered. And, you know, I can sit for 3 minutes and start smiling very smugly about what I've done. I think that there, I hope it comes through that how much pleasure I take in making those drawings. But they definitely have the quality, or I think it comes through, of me kind of slapping blindly at a pile of art supplies, which is how I work.
Where I think you excel in this style, one, I think of my students all the time and how to show them that this is okay. We don't have to fill in the white space. We can, I mean, you're drawing with crayon or what material like crayon, and you're
crayon, literal crayon.
Sweet, good. You are using the materials that they have at the ready.
Yeah.
But what I like about this feel too is the looseness of your line. Only you're doing it like full color style. I think about people like Jules Feiffer or Matt Cordell or somebody like that who've got this beautiful loose line and just sort of can run with it. And you're doing that not only with your line, but also with what you're filling in on the character with your colors and that quality. For you to be able to know when is it right to leave it, when is it okay to go out, and what clearly you're being ruled by feeling a lot and you're trusting yourself, but that trust, it pays off really, really well.
Oh, thank you so much. I think one of the things that I've kind of learned is, and it's funny because I, as an art director, I help people a lot kind of shape final artwork. And I also, as a person who's attended and done portfolio critiques and things like that for, SCWI and things like that. One of the things that I'm always trying to impart in other people that I tried to put into my own work is knowing when to stop. Because I think that sometimes, and there are people who render and render and render, and the drafting is intense and beautiful. Like, I think of somebody like Brian Floke, where you look at a piece like that and, like, not a line out of place, but beautiful and just like elegant and clean work. But that the amount of lines for some people that you continue to add may actually draw away from something instead of adding to something. And so as part of my process, when I look at the work that I'm making, I actually use my phone a lot, and that I take a lot of images, pictures while I'm working. And that sometimes informs me in that it says to me, like, well, I should have stopped 10 minutes ago.
But you have because, them then, so you know where you can go back to. You can rewind in a way.
Yeah. And that's, you know, that's often when I'm trying to create a piece of artwork or an illustration, that is the preamble to making the piece that I actually think is effective a lot of the time, is to work and then sometimes overwork and wish I could walk back, which without the powers of undo, can be tricky. But
and you're working in traditional medium, so that's what happens.
Yeah, I would say that I work fully traditionally, and then I would never want anyone to misunderstand. I definitely do some like compositing. So I do, my backgrounds are independent of my characters.
Oh, okay.
So that's a gouache wash that I did like in post, as they would say, but. But yeah, for the most part, it really is kind of sitting there with a pad on my lap, which is my studio.
Your studio is a pad on your lap.
Yep, facing the television.
Goodness, that's amazing.
Don't tell children that part, though.
Children, look at my book. Now, see it as a testament of the good that television can do in your life.
Yes, television isn't, a little, you know, everything in moderation, television included, if you ask me. But I know other people feel differently.
Okay, so tell me more about what it means to be an art director. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you sort of where I am in the understanding of the process of making a book, and maybe that's where other people are. Maybe they're beyond where I am, but that's all good. So I understand writing a manuscript and selling it to a publisher, and the publisher finding an illustrator if you are the author only. I get that. And then I get that the illustrator sort of gets to work at trying to break apart the manuscript and figure out where the beats are, and this is all after the author will work with an editor, and then the illustrator is working with you. So how much are you involved, maybe on a, it's probably case by case, but how much are you involved in the process?
Well, this is, it's very funny because it really is case by case. So there are a range of way that things come to us. Like you said, there are times when an editor will acquire a manuscript with no one attached, and then the art director's relationship with the editor at that point will be typically for me, like, here are three people I think, like, in my own reading of this, would really that I personally,
so you, Lucy, are recommending. Got
yeah, it. That I recommend. And so that at that point, you know, either these are people that everybody is aware of, and they can, the editor is aware of a book of theirs, or I'll pull together like a tear sheet of samples that I feel like best evoke what I'm picturing for the text. But it is kind of a matchmaking relationship. So, you know, in that process, I'm sharing that with both the publisher, and I, you know, I have an executive art director who's above me, and she vets my my selections and that kind of thing. But it really is kind of like almost like an arranged marriage, where then once that's kind of resolved, you'll often kind of detect someone's mode of working if you haven't worked with them before. There are times when we have a text that has no page breaks or no art notes, and then there are times when we have a thing that's completely blocked out with page breaks and art notes that come from the writer. And so, you know, executing those, you know, with interest is the illustrator's job. But then there are times when what's delivered is more something in lines of like a poem type text, which I would say is like something that requires thought on the illustrator's part on where those breaks will go. And sometimes just in feel at the start of a process, depending on my relationship with the editor, will work out where we think the page breaks are. and kind of start with that as a pitch. But that's all pretty evolving, that process, because I think that a lot of times when you're sketching something start to finish, you'll sense where that page turn is, where it wasn't, right. Or you'll sense when that shred of text one page later, one page earlier will heighten things. And it's really kind of, I know it sounds corny to say, but it's kind of like playing music where you want to build and then pull back and build and pull back. And so that relationship varies illustrator to illustrator. Some people really just want you to tell them what you want. And some people say, I want time to, you know, cloister myself with this text and deliver to you what my vision is. At which point then sometimes we move forward with sketches before including the author again, or sometimes everybody's in the conversation at once. But I tend to kind of like to have those relationships a little walled off, at least at the beginning, because I think there's something beautiful about, is it explication? Is that when you look through the text of a poem? I like the idea of an illustrator bringing something to a story that was there.
Yeah, without maybe
within
saying
themselves.
Thing.
Yeah,
let's just see how what they interpret it, and maybe there is something there that we can use that we can even, you know, amplify because
we like it
so much. Or
yeah, and that's kind of the amazing thing about keeping those relationships a little more isolated, in my experience. But then there are people who work naturally with each other all the time, and the relationship between the way that the writer crafts the text has something to do with their knowledge of the illustrator, their knowledge of the biography of the illustrator, and how these things will synthesize. But I think some of my most fun efforts as an art director have been here comes from the editor a beautiful text or a funny text or a great text, and I can't even wait to deliver it like a gift to the illustrator I'm dreaming of working with. And then as the start of the process is like crazy. It's like having a baby many times a year without all of the horrible symptoms of pregnancy.
And so you're also at some point then, I mean, the illustrator obviously isn't just like taking the manuscript and making the art and then it's done. You're looking at it and at some point saying like, this is good just like this, let's make this final art and work on this. So you must be working through sketches or something, right?
Yeah, so what we'll do, we tend to do, and everybody works very differently.
Yeah.
I like to see at the start of the process like thumbnails with a synopsis of what you think the visual story is going to be, and then an actual set of sketches, and then from sketches, revised sketches, and then from revised sketches, final art. And at some point along that line, usually, it's funny because at Simon & Schuster, where I work, we have a pre-press department that preps our files before they go abroad. Typically, we print picture books abroad.
Yeah.
And so typically right after the sketch process, a color piece finished to look at will come in to give us direction for the actual final artwork. And at that point, we'll actually proof that color piece for the artist so they can see how we're interpreting their work and make sure it's in line with what they expected, and also that we know that the palette is what we expected, or that we know that the tone or the characters, because a lot of times sketches can be, I mean, I've seen sketches that were three slashes on a page from an illustrator I've worked with before, and I know exactly what those slashes are going to look like onto the most rendered thing you've ever seen in your entire life.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So at any given time, like today you went to work, how many different projects do you have going? And I know they're all in different places, but how many different projects do you typically have going at a time?
This will be like a ballpark, but I'd say like a million.
Wow, okay.
It's like kind of like maybe like 2 million. It's funny because sometimes it can feel like that, and sometimes
ballpark. So
yeah. So something in the range of like the under 5 million, but like, you know, like what's that like with Price is Right guesses? Yeah.
$1.
Yeah, $1. The funny thing is that so since I work on picture books, middle grain and young adult, I always every day I will definitely work on a picture book, a middle grade and a young adult. In some part of the process, I'll touch each of those every day.
Aside from like maybe spot illustrations and the cover, What else are you doing with middle grade and young adult? Are you part of then looking at the whole design, the layout of the, oh, I love that.
Yeah. So it's so funny because in college I studied graphic design. That was what my focus was.
Yeah.
And so coming in, like when you start out, or I should say when I started out 13 years ago, the focus at Simon & Schuster was very heavily picture books, a good deal middle grade, and then scant teen. Like there were a few teen authors, but it wasn't really a primary focus. And then there was a huge flip on its ear where we were heavily teen focused, dabbling in middle grade and light on picture books. And that was just a market shift. And like I think exactly the Twilight phenomenon.
Right.
So like the late aughts, is that aughts? I often wade into words. I'm not quite sure if they're right, or also that I would use it in an email but haven't said aloud. So you'll have to excuse my bravery with my vocabulary that has not been road tested at all, but I can spell. Maybe I'll just start spelling the words out instead of saying them in the podcast and people can follow along at home. So the funny thing was that when I was brought on initially, you know, picture books were a solid part of it, but I was doing a lot of flowing middle grade interiors and stuff like that. And like my first projects were like Bruce Koval, like type stuff. And so, you'll see Simon & Schuster is one of the, publishers that's kind of neat in that, we give design credit. You'll see it printed in the books. And so you'll see my hands and my credit, on things you would not expect. But I touch every part of every book that comes out, basically. If that means that I flowed the entire interior or I set sample pages. But yeah, I've looked at everything and planned. It's all, I guess, more thoughtful than I think I would have even expected from the outside.
Yeah, I like that you have been a part of sort of every part of the process. That it's not as if it's like in an assembly line, there's a point where first you write it and then it's handed to you and then it's passed on, but that you've seen all of these different works at all different points.
Yeah. It's kind of cool. And it's also funny though, as a reader though, I have to say that like, I remember a time three years into my job where I was reading an adult book and I thought, oh, my line spacing's too loose. like looking at set by somebody else, I was like, oh no. But just in general, that's just graphic design woes that keep me up at night now, this many years later.
I hear that. I've got similar things that happen in teaching. All do in all of our craft, but
yeah.
I got that. Well, I'm glad that you coming from this world that you do means that you've been exposed to, well, if currently you're looking at 2 million books, then over 13 years, we've got a couple billion.
It's got to be, what is it, 26 million?
Yeah, okay, we'll take it.
Yeah.
And, yeah, you're right, because you can't finish a million projects in a day, so they must carry over. You're right.
Yes,
you're right.
Exactly.
No, but I like all of that combined, the way that it then informs the way you've designed this book. I love the trim size of A Hungry Lion. I especially love, well, you're working with, we'll get into you working with Carter Higgins, but Carter and Travis just started the Undies, the award for the case covers, and you've got beautiful case covers on
your book. Thank you very much. That the Undies, I have to say that the funny thing about working on this picture book is that I have someone who is considered my publicist. And Aubrey's kind of amazing in that she keeps me up to date on everything that's going on. And the best email I've received as yet regarding A Hungry Lion was definitely that I was a nominee for the Undies. Just because it's unlike any other press contact I've received. That's amazing. And the company is outstanding.
Just because I don't want to leave anyone in the dark.
Yes.
The Undies, the case
don't
cover.
Leave the Undies in the dark.
Don't leave the Undies in the dark. Let's expose the Undies.
Yes.
What we're referring to is just when you take off the dust jacket, just what's on the actual like hard cover.
Mm-hmm.
And in your case, it starts with like a spotlight on the lion and ends with a spotlight on a turtle.
Perhaps arbitrary. Who knows?
And I like too that your spine has this like solid yellow spine.
Oh.
The color changes.
I could talk to you for a month about the spine.
Tell me.
Yes.
This is a deliberate design, right?
Yeah, oh my goodness. Well, this is the crazy thing. So I worked on the book, and obviously the weird thing about publishing at Simon & Schuster is that I'm in direct contact almost constantly with all these people working a project while I'm still working on all my other projects.
Yes.
And I happened to be in a production meeting, which is basically where we just say, like, here's the status of this title and what stage it's at. And so I was in a production meeting talking about any of the 2 million books that I handle. And at one point, one of the production managers, Hava Wallen, who worked on my book, passed a sample of a case, which is what the underside is there of the case, passed that to another art director. And I glanced over and I saw this basically like what looked like a cloth spine, which is something I haven't seen since my childhood. Like they don't do them like that. And they don't do foil stamping on cases typically.
Right.
And it was very funny because my editor, Justin Chanda, was in that meeting as well. And as I snatched this out of the passing down to somebody else process, I just kind of gestured at him with like puppy dog eyes. And he nodded approvingly that we could get that done. And so, but it's like, it's tough because like I see that, I know that we're, you know, there's a little sack of pennies and you have to push them all around in different directions. And, you know, not everything is cost effective, but that to me, that's fine. If I could, that's fine. That's fine as everything. That would be the front of my portfolio at this point. I'm so happy how beautiful it is.
Yeah.
That's so, but I should point out, and I've heard this caveat in a lot of your, in your podcast that, I got to work with an art director too at Simon & Schuster. My friend Sonia was my art director, and she was a big advocate for a lot of the very pretty things that ended up happening in my book too. But thank you for observing the texture of my spine.
I think all those little details, the way that the kid experiences the book, or any reader, the way that I as an adult experience that book, and that goes all the way down to, you know, I'm often found talking about the way that a page feels, the weight of the page, the smell of the glue, just all of that. There's so many things that really, it seems romantic, but it is sort of in a way that, like, to close your eyes and just run your fingers against the book. That picture book, the reason why picture books endure as they do in print is because there's this relationship you have with the tangible qualities of a picture book that are deliberate. They don't go away. So I like to call out on the podcast a lot those choices, because everyone made a choice somewhere for every aspect of this book. The reason why the case cover has a different illustration, or the end papers look like this, or the paper has this weight, all of it is a choice.
Yeah. Well, you know what's so funny? I was just listening to your podcast with Lisa Brown, and she was talking, and she had kind of a funny thing she was mentioning about how she didn't know what the bag of tricks was necessarily going in. And the problem, I think, for my publisher with having published me is I know every trick in the bag.
Yes.
Like, and I know exactly how many pennies per copy it adds.
Yeah, Lisa,
and so,
had brought up, to for those who hadn't heard it yet, I had commented to Lisa as well. Beautiful case cover in her book for the airport book.
Yes.
Airplane on the cover. On the jacket, you can open it all the way and see this full airplane. When you take it off, it's just her cast of characters. And she has like 30 or 40 characters that
you follow. It's
nutty.
Yes.
And so the fact that made it onto the case, she had just said her perspective was, I had to ask it up front so that it was something that everyone was thinking about from the very, very beginning.
Yeah. Well, you know what? It's so funny because one thing that we think about sometimes when we do a book jacket is the idea that in a library setting, you might not be seeing it jacketed.
No, I was just going to say we often take
so
off
we have
the
that
jacket.
Argument. We have that argument all the time, which is like, and, you know, from that perspective, it's not like a librarian is probably going to be the person who puts that in someone's hands.
That's
if there's nothing singing from the shelf, like, to say exactly what the content is. But it is a conversation that we have, which is like, is a different case cover for the advantage of the book buyer? And, you know, it adds to the art experience of the book hugely, we think all the time. But then, you know, there are books that have their greatest life within a library setting.
Yes.
And sometimes it's harder to make that choice when you know that it might not travel with its dust jacket all the time.
I will say, though, that as a librarian, I find it really adorable and endearing.
Yeah.
I think about Beagle. Beagle was sort of
the big one with the different
case covers. But to have kids gently, if you teach them to be gentle, to sort of bend backwards the spine and peek in.
Yeah.
It's not unlike, to me, Charlie Bucket looking for his golden ticket. Yeah. It's like that, seeing a glimmer of something different. So I think it's okay. They might not be able to remove that jacket, and that's okay. There's something to them being able to peek.
Well, it's so funny because the other funny thing was that a lot of these things happen in conversation where we'll have an artist approach us with a great idea, and then it's a matter of having a conversation with a production manager in-house who's going to really get that book printed. And a lot of the production managers are really creative about how they can handle those things. But I think that in Simon & Schuster, that was a thing where we realized that didn't add a tremendous cost, and it added a huge value.
Good.
So I think you'll see it more and more. I think you're going to find that the undies get increasingly hard to whittle down to a small nominee class.
Well, and hopefully it's something like that too, that just because that award exists, I mean, likewise, we should have an
motivating
award. We should have an award for book trailers in the same way, but I know that book trailers don't often come from the publisher. Often that's, if you're lucky enough to be for an illustrator who knows animation really well, you can make gorgeous book trailers. But it's that same reason, just for us librarians and teachers to send a message back to publishing that we do notice, and it does matter to us.
Yeah.
These are special things.
Well, we're all freaking out about the undies, so don't worry. I can say that from both hats that I wear. It's very exciting and very cool.
Well, it's yeah, it's Carter Higgins and Travis Junker, two people that I adore the heck out of. And Carter, you could play a... we were talking about... out of the possibility that children are listening, we were talking about games you can play based on the occurrence of things coming up over and over.
Yes, just
those
games.
Kind of games.
About volume and repetition.
I have been teased by Carter herself about the game we could play for how often I bring her up, but it's out of adoration. And really, to say publicly on record to you that the way I came to know A Hungry Lion was because everyone on Twitter and Facebook was sharing pictures of it, talking lovingly about it. And then all of a sudden, Carter Higgins was like, "You're never going to believe who they got to illustrate my picture book. Lucy Ruth Cummins."
That's so cool. That's so nutty.
Yeah.
I think we had, you and I might have even had an exchange on Twitter where I was like going like ape about how excited I was about her book, and I think you'd already seen the text, so it wasn't lost on you that there was quality there because you'd already read it. But I was like evangelizing about my own excitement to someone who was already familiar with how good it was.
That is definitely true. I can remember that. That is definitely true.
Yeah, yeah. I felt like a real dummy at that point because I was like, "No, guys, believe me, this is a really good book." But so, like, so
there's this funny thing.
Ridiculous.
So the podcast that posted right before me talking to you now, the one that posted today proper, which is whatever, a couple weeks ago in the past from whenever you're listening, was with Min Lay and Isabel Rojas, and it was about Let Me Finish. And the reason why that's relevant to this conversation is that Min is a book blogger. He does bottom shelf books and writes articles for lots of big publications. And so, like Carter, to have someone come from sort of, not that there's a fence, but I was going to say on our side of the fence here and coming out with something on the other, someone who talks about picture books all the time. I read Carter's stuff. I told her that I did my very best to do what a publisher does, which is to sort of ignore the name on the cover. But I read both of her picture books and
I haven't seen the second one, by the way. So you're torturing
me. Beautiful. She's got her poetic.
Oh, it's crazy. It's crazy. It's crazy. It's, and I completely understand that idea of feeling like, because I, in doing my own picture book, I had just kind of peered over the fence and thought, am I really going to write one? I totally get it. Like, there's almost a feeling in your head of, they do that, I don't necessarily do that. And, but then, when that text came through, I was like, because especially as a person who sees a lot of texts, and manuscripts coming through, that it's so good.
But isn't
so
that Carter
excited.
Though? As a person who reads as many picture books as she does, the poetic sensibility she has in her text is
nutty.
Remind me, what's the name of
This Is Not a book? Valentine.
This Is Not a Valentine. I can remember the text. I think I actually even quoted her back telling her what a beautiful book it was, but I don't retain titles very well. But so So beautiful. And yeah, to have really it come excited. Out with Chronicle, and you're working on beginning sketches now, right?
Yeah, so the way that it works was I saw the text for the first time this spring and pretended that, you know, it was just a good text.
You were all like nonchalant.
It's very, very measured.
This is
well, it's
good.
Very funny because, as I said, like in the process of being an actor, I try to keep a little space. So Carter and I are internet friends, but we're not, you know, like IRL friends. And so there was a part of me that had read something beautiful that she wrote, but knowing that my agent, Emily Van Beek, was going to have conversations with Taylor Norman at Chronicle and make arrangements with this, you have to play it close to your vest. But at the same time, I was playing close to my vest and my heart was pounding in my chest. Like, because I was like, it's like stalking a deer where you're like, I know what kind of texts come people's way, and this is like an extremely special book. And like, and I knew immediately on reading it exactly what it should be. And I had that feeling, and this is like overly grand, of thinking like, even if it's not me, I hope this is how it ends up being. Like, this is what I hope for this story. I'll talk to Taylor and Carter and tell them what I think, and they can take it somewhere else if they think I'm not appropriately seated to do what I want to do. But in the end, I think we all agreed that it's a big love fest. And so they're working on my sketches now, and then I'll move on to make some final artwork, and hopefully it will be at a caliber that matches the text, which is really gorgeous.
Lucy, that's a whole lot of love right there. That's beautiful.
It's almost too much. It's a little bit too much.
That's beautiful.
I'm glad that I've, like, able to have the space from Artie agreeing to do it without having to give up too much of how I actually feel, which is like maximum extreme excitement.
I love
so,
it. Well, yeah. Listen, it's been a great chat. Time has flown. Lucy, I've really enjoyed my time with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
You have an insane amount of amazing experiences that you pour into your picture book, and God, this book, I've told you, this book, everyone needs this book. It's a beautiful book.
Read this book.
I can't wait. I mean, having just read it now over the summer, it's a book that will be on the top of my pile when I go back to the school, to the
That's
new school
thrill.
Year, to read it to my students and just feel this book with them. That's
I
wonderful.
Can't. That's so cool. Thank you so much.
Of course. Well, my pleasure. I'm going to end our conversation here with giving you the last word and with a question that harkens back to why we do what we do and the people we do it for. So, Lucy, I'm going to see a library full of children tomorrow morning or whatever morning. Mm-hmm. I'd love to know what message you would like me to bring to them from you.
I would have to say that the thing I would encourage every kid to do is to try everything they want to try without being intimidated by thinking somebody else is better than them or more qualified. I think that one of the weird experiences in making a picture book after being on the other side of it for so long was thinking, I can think of so many people who are more talented than I am or have a different perspective that I wish I could make artwork like them or something like that. But that I would tell children that your individual experience and your individual talents are what you offer, and that you don't need to be pushed off the spot of trying because you have something to bring to the table that's distinctive, whether that's with your artwork or your writing or your athleticism or anything like that. But that you don't have to look to somebody who's more talented than yourself or how you perceive them to be. And let that stop you from doing something that you're passionate about.
This podcast is recorded and produced by me, Matthew Winner, in my library studio in Ellicott City, Maryland. You can subscribe to the podcast and access the archive of over 250 episodes at All the Wonders, a home for readers to discover new books and to experience the stories they love in wondrous ways. Go beyond the book at allthewonders.com and check out other podcasts from All the Wonders, including the Picture Booking Podcast with Nick Patton, a semi-weekly podcast about picture books and the people who make them. Our theme music is by Emily Arrow.
All views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the individuals, myself included, and do not reflect ideas or viewpoints of the publishers of the books referenced. Listeners, if the episode connected with you, I'd love to hear it. Leave a comment on allthewonders.com or rate this podcast on iTunes or Stitcher through stars or reviews. Sharing the podcast with friends through Facebook and Twitter, word of mouth, or any other means helps reach more listeners, which leads to more content and more amazing guests. And that's a very good thing indeed. Coming up on the podcast, Evan Turk shares The Storyteller, his picture book debut as both author and illustrator. And after that, Beth Kephart visits All the Wonders to share This is the Story of You, a young adult novel so beautiful it begged to be read aloud. See you then, and thanks for listening. We know you value what you put in front of your kids, especially when it comes to screens and podcasts. That's why we're excited to share a new podcast from our friends at Sleepiest, creating bedtime stories to help your kids fall asleep fast.
Hello, Abby here. If you've got children and find bedtime's a struggle, I'd like to tell you about Coco Sleep, a children's story podcast designed to make bedtime a dream. Coco Sleep turns a chaotic bedtime into cozy bonding time. The stories are delivered in a pace that gently slows. Rumour has it that no one's ever heard an ending. So search Coco Sleep on your favourite podcast app and let's make bedtime a dream. That's K-O-K-O Sleep, and I'll see you there.